This is Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the music and the artists behind the 2017 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School and previews upcoming performances. Good afternoon, I'm Chris Moore. This program comes to you from Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and can be heard online at aspenpublicradio.org. Funding for Festival Showcase on Aspen Public Radio is provided by the Barnard Fane Foundation. Today we look forward to two concerts. We'll be talking with John Rojak, bass trombonist with the American Brass Quintet, which will fill the Resonant Harris Hall with sound on July 20th at 8 p.m. But first, though, let's talk with pianist Jean-Yves Thibaudet, whose July 23rd performance of the Liszt Piano Concerto No. 2 promises to be as colorful as his conversation and his choice of clothing.
You're kind of an explorer. I mean, the classical music world has, there are stereotypes of us. You button up in your tuxedo and walk around looking like a penguin, and that you play every single note that is written, no improvisation allowed, those sorts of things. You seem to kind of chafe at some of those images. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about where you stand, because clearly you're a classical performer, and yet not like every other classical performer.
I'll get you all of that, and I agree with you. The only thing, and I'm still trying to play the notes that I've written.
Right.
I'm joking, but once I saw this program on British TV many, many years ago, where Andrew Previn was the guest, and he made a joke saying, I played all the right notes, not necessarily in the right order. And that was so funny.
That's true, because he liked jazz too, so he had to defend himself against that, I suppose.
No, I think it's been, as far as the clothing goes, I mean, actually, I think it's the entire, it actually all goes together and is all linked together. I think it's just, I always thought for many, many years that the image of classical music was just wrong. It was, as you said, it was given that incredible old tradition with the clothes that you had to wear, men had to wear. The tails and the white vest and the bow tie. It was just so dusty, so like a turn off for younger people. They're looking at that, they're like, wow, this is not my thing. You know, how could that be my thing? Look at that. And it just was ridiculous. And I said, time, you know, ladies can wear the most outstanding dresses, whatever they want. And there we are. We still have to wear the same thing for the last 300 years. Mm-hmm. I said, that's not fair.
Right.
I started rebelling against that. That was my first attempt at that. I was always curious about other music and lots of music, and I listened to all kinds of music, and I think that's very important for me, and it's extremely enriching, and it enriched my classical music as well, whether I play jazz or pop artists or ethnic music like Brazilian music or tango music, anything. I'm always interested in listening to other kinds of music, and if I like it, great. If I don't like it, I just won't listen again. It's very simple. But I'm always curious. It's like food. You want to try it. You have to try it. And you cannot be just in your little world and just play your little piano music. But that just doesn't work. I also was always very interested in doing all kinds of variety. Of course, concertos, recital, but also chamber music, lots of chamber music, playing for singers, which is great for me. I love playing for singers. Soundtracks, as I just said. I mean, I need all those different experiences. I'm just a very curious person. And I think I would get bored if I just had if I was just doing it only, you know, regular things, and I think I would get bored very easily. So I need to have all this project, and I believe more and more in collaboration. I think collaborations are great for the artist, I think also for the audience, and especially if you can have different worlds of music meet. I think this is, to me, is right now the most exciting things that are happening, to meet people from different genres of music and do things together, because we are inspiring each other and we can learn from each other. We admire what the other does. Oh my God, how do you do that? And then what I do, and it's really fascinating to see how you can put all those things together. So I like to do some research in that as well.
You mentioned very briefly opera singers, and I know that you play with opera singers. When I talk to string players, they often say that they are trying to, actually a bass trombone player I was just talking to was saying that he learns a lot by studying the voice and trying to create vocal inflection on his bass trombone. Do you feel the same way with the piano, that you learn something about how to create almost a vocal line with your piano?
Absolutely. This is the entire idea of playing with a singer. I mean, first of all, it's the beauty. I mean, I just happen to love the voice, to love opera, to love everything about the voice since I was a kid. And more when I grew up, the opera and all that became really a big part of my life. But I think the point is exactly that. The piano is a percussive instrument, and you have to somehow forget it. I mean, it will always be. But in your dreams, you have to forget it and pretend that you can sing with your piano. This is ultimately what I'm trying to do. Sing all the time. I look at a phrase, I will sing it to myself, and I will try to sing it at the piano. And you can pretend you're doing that. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just the legato doesn't really exist at the piano, but we can try to make it exist. And the example that the voice gives you, you learn, I think musically I learned more from my experiences playing for singer than with all my piano teachers. I mean, this is beyond music. It's beyond everything. Just the voice, it's just the breathing, which is so important. And as a pianist, you don't have to really work on your breathing. It's not like, you know, a wind play, or we just play and play and play. And breathing is so important, and phrasing and legato and shaping of the phrase. I mean, all of those things that are normal for a singer, we just don't speak and don't think about them as a pianist, technically. So I learned a tremendous amount of that playing for singers.
It's not only that you happen to be playing the Liszt Second Piano Concerto when you come to Aspen here, but you're really well known as somebody who's a great admirer of Liszt's music.
Yes.
What do you love so much about him? And does he remind you a little bit of Debussy? I mean, because sometimes if you get away from the dazzling showpieces, some of his music actually sounds impressionistic to me.
But I have to say that I have a certain admiration and fascination by Liszt the person. And I think he must have been just an incredible human being. I think in those days, he was so ahead of his time. He was so modern and so innovative in every way, not only in his music, but thing in his lifestyle. And I mean, he was, I think he invented PR somehow. He was a Michael Jackson of the time. I mean, the guy was going around and playing concerts, and the women were fainting in front of him, trying to, you know, steal some of his gloves or his shirt or whatever it was. He was really a superstar. And it's so funny, in those days, I think this was, and he was championing his music, but he was championing all his peers' music as well. He was playing Beethoven at the piano to show people, to make a bit more publicity for that. Wagner, of course. I mean, so many things. He was really quite a remarkable person. So I'm fascinated by it. I read a lot of his letters and I mean, all his life, of course, biographies. And it's something that really I'm very interested in. And I think musically, sometimes people think of Liszt as a kind of shallow musician, as you say, virtuosity, pyrotechnical thing, and not very deep, you know, not a very serious musician. And this is so, so wrong. So he was one of the most important composers, one of the deepest, amazing composers. And when you look at some of his work going later in his life, all at the end, all the religious stuff, absolutely, it's like meditative music. It's like in another level of spirituality. People don't know, but he wrote lots of songs, for example, and the leaders, I played a lot of his leaders, they are fascinating. Maybe some of his most introspective music, and then so touching and so beautiful. I think there really is, in fact, I think what I would say is that Debussy maybe took over from Liszt in a certain way, also the way he wrote for the piano sometimes. I tend to think, but also so Ravel in a way. I mean, Ravel was a more classical composer, but we see, for example, Jodot, when he wrote the Jodot, he was making a little, you know, wink at Liszt, who wrote the Jodot à la Villa d'Este. Also, when he wrote Carbo, I mean, Ravel wanted to write things that were really difficult. He said it when he wrote Carbo, he said, I want this to be the most difficult piece ever written for the piano. It's more difficult than Balakirev et Islamé and more. So he had that kind of virtuoso thing that he was fascinated by, a bit like Liszt was. But I think Liszt and Debussy are maybe harmonically more connected. I think with Ravel, more connected maybe with a way to write for the piano than really virtuoso. Debussy is not very often incredibly virtuoso. But I think harmonically, and I mean, this is connection from Liszt. And Liszt, because Liszt was very modern for his time, as I said, I think some of his music, especially getting to the end of his life, was almost impressionistic, whatever that's supposed to mean. But that's, I think, what you mean. It's just that it was very modern and very atmospheric with those sounds and those kind of, which is fascinating at that time when you think when it was written. It's just, and he was the first, although, to take the example of the Second Concerto, in those days to write a concerto that didn't have a first movement, a second movement, a scherzo, a finale, whatever. It was brand new to the concerto in one big movement with sections, of course, but then to have also all the sections connected to each other. It's one theme that is connected in every part. It's like the life and development of one theme. What can you do with one theme? It's incredible. It comes in every form, in every speed, in every feeling. It's quite fascinating. So that was all very unusual for the time.
You've been performing this for a very, very long time, but when you were first trying to tackle him, was he a particularly difficult and challenging composer to get under your fingers so that you could actually play it?
Actually, I started playing the Liszt when I was really young. I remember doing a little concert in Lyon, my hometown, when I was 11, and I remember that I chose to play Hungarian Rhapsody by Liszt. I think it was the 11th, actually. I think number 11. And then the Jodo Avila Desi came very often. It was one of my favorite pieces, even in competitions. And then lots of other things. So he was always part of my literature and part of my language, in a way. I think Liszt, of course, you know, it's incredibly well written for the piano because the man was a monster pianist. It's really sad that we don't have any recording or anything, because I think we would just not believe it. I think it's beyond human what you could do with his fingers, because a lot of the things he has written have been revised two or three times in his life. He kept revising things. And when you look at the first version and the last version, in fact, he made it simpler. And it's still so difficult when you look at the score. But believe it or not, the first version was actually much more difficult and complex. And he probably realized that nobody was ever going to be able to play it the way it was written.
Right.
That he'd better make it a bit, I mean, simplify is a funny word, because it's still so difficult. But his technical abilities were beyond belief. I mean, it must have been really incredible. So it is very well written for the piano. I think also Liszt had big hands, from what we know, like Rachmaninoff. Mm-hmm. I have big hands. And I think this is also another thing. You know how some things feel more comfortable when you put your fingers on them and they feel more comfortable and you play them? It's still difficult, but you feel confident. Some others feel awkward. Well, I think Liszt always felt good in my fingers. So it was always a very important part of my literature that I'm playing. I've always played a lot of this. But the second concerto I learned right later in my life, because I played the first very often since very young. I was asked, was actually my first recording, official recording with Decca when they signed me in the late 80s, was to record the Liszt concertos, and I had for that to learn the second. So I learned it rather quickly then, but it's true that I had never played it before. I had to learn it, perform it a few times, and then record it. And I have to say that over the time now, over the years, I think it became my favorite of the two. I think I play more the second than the first now.
Mm-hmm.
It's just much more interesting musically, much more poetic. I mean, the first is brilliant, and it's got some nice moments too, but the second I find is just a really mesmerizing piece. It's such a dialogue also with the orchestra. I think the first is a real piano concerto with the orchestra most of the time accompanying the piano. This one is almost like chamber music by some time, and this is what I really adore about it. It's this slow section where you have the duo with the cello. It's like playing a cello sonata suddenly. And that's so rewarding with the orchestra. I think they also, everybody has its moment in that concerto. It's a moment for everybody. Clarinet, the oboe, first violin, everybody has a moment. And I really like that. It's a real collaboration. It's a teamwork with the orchestra.
And in addition to Liszt, you have a lot of recordings out and performances of Debussy, of Messiaen, of Erik Satie. As a Frenchman, is it easier for you to feel an affinity for French composers?
I personally don't really believe in it too much. I think it's more complex than that. I mean, what is it being French? Is it me having a French passport? I mean, you can be Japanese and work in France all your life. So I think it's beyond the nationality. I think it really is a culture thing. It's true that most people that are French usually grew up in France, which is my case. And in that case, this is what it is. I think it's growing up in the country is a tradition, is a culture. I think also my lineage with the piano teachers. I mean, one of my teachers was really the epitome of French school. There is one, Lucette Descartes. She met Ravel, played with him. She was a collaborator of Ravel and Marguerite Lohan. So she really was the French piano school in a way. So I had all of that heritage and tradition, which I think, of course, makes a difference. But also a teacher who was completely on the German side, and so I feel I'm not just a French pianist, but I do have a certain affinity, I have to say, with French music. It's true, and I think it's something that I feel very attracted to, also since a quite young age. Ravel and Debussy, but even more Ravel, I think, was always part of my repertoire from a very early age. I think by age 15, I had learned the complete Ravel piano works. I was already playing them all in one way or another. So that was really quite terrific. So it has been part of it, but I was always careful, because people have a tendency, I don't know why, it's like a disease. I think, like, if you're French, you have to play French music. If you're Russian, you have to play Russian music. And I think that's a little bit too much. I mean, you know, some other people can play beautiful French music. As I said, you need to be interested in the culture, in the tradition, but you don't have to be French for that. I think it's perfectly possible also. So it just happened that in my case, I mean, I had all the cards in my hands, so to speak, to have that education.
I have to ask about Erik Satie. I know you talk about your fascination with Liszt the man, not just the composer and the music that was written.
Yes.
One of my friends, actually, his name is Erik Satie. He's a great-grandson of Erik Satie. He told me that his great-grandfather left behind no money at all. He was destitute. The only thing he left behind were hundreds of umbrellas.
Oh, yes.
And I just wonder if, when you learn these stories about the composers, do you ever pick up any of their quirks?
You know, it's terribly important. I think people don't take enough time for that. When you play a composer, or when you learn a new piece or about a composer, I think you have to know about the person, about the man. You have to know the lives, about what was going on around the time that they wrote a certain piece. I mean, all of that is so important, not just the notes. In the case of Satie, it's fascinating to see what happened. I mean, it's one of the richest times in history. At the turn of the century in France, was just the center of the world for artists. Was amazing what was going on, and he was the most eccentric, interesting person, incredibly intelligent. I think his eccentricity was part of it. I think was just a game he was playing. I think a lot of it is he wanted to see how far he would get away with, and he realized that he could go really far, and people.
This was Paris in the '20s.
I mean, he was having really fun with that, and I think a lot of people didn't take him seriously. And again, I think he's an extremely important composer that had a very important part and influence in the piano of the 20th century and the development of the piano. And again, all the Debussy, even Messiaen, all the, and then later jazz, all related to Satie. Satie was an incredible. He was 50 years before John Cage. He was the first minimalist in a way, you know, writing this kind of music. I mean, it was completely unknown for those times.
Jean-Yves, you are a huge wine collector. I wonder if there exists any connection between wine and music. For 20 years, I taught wine and classical music tasting for a charity, for a soup kitchen, and it was tremendously popular, and everybody thought it was a great idea. I thought it was, at first I thought it was not a good idea, but it turned out to be great. Do you feel that there's a connection between other kinds of wine that you like to drink with Schubert or with Debussy,
definitely,
other composers?
and I speak often about it with friends in the wine business and also winemakers and wine lovers. And there really is an incredible connection between wine and music. And I think people don't always realize, but if you start searching and drinking wine and learning a little bit more about wine, each wine has its own character, especially the great wines. And they have a real personality, and you recognize them. If you drink them twice, if you had them once and you had them another time, you will remember the first time you had them and say, oh, that's right, I had this one before. And it reminds you, and they have all those different unique qualities. And also they give you feelings and they give you emotions. I mean, wine to me, a good wine, it's an emotion. You can really find those elements with the music and you can really connect them. And I think it's a very interesting discussion and a very interesting exercise. When you think of having friends over or having a nice bottle of wine you're going to share with friends, I think you need to, I need to think of music and what music are you going to listen to with it. Or it's like pairing wine with food. You can also pair it with music.
Well, then you have to give us a few examples. When you're playing some Mozart chamber music, like string quartets, what kind of grape do you like?
I don't know. For example, I think to make it very simple, I think some wine are more feminine and some wine are more masculine, for example. I mean, it's all very subjective and very personal. And it's a very thin line. So it's a discussion you need to have trying those wines in your hands and listening to the music. But I think you have to make categories. Yeah? And I think, first of all, this is the first thing I would say. This wine is more feminine, so it's more masculine. Some more robust. Has to do also with the grapes, of course. And then we can become more and more selective. And at the end, you can really find a composer that goes with, and then even a certain piece. But as I said, it's very subjective. It can change also.
Now, when it comes to more dissonant music, I mean, I can see like Wagner with a big full-bodied red wine and a soft white wine with Mozart. But when it comes to some of the 20th century composers whose music I really love, like Bartok, when he's being really biting and dissonant in some of his string quartets, I haven't really found a wine that I like with it.
There are some biting wines. There are some really biting wines. There's some really interesting wines from other places in the world. People don't think about it, but the wines are, of course, France produces great wines. America now produces wonderful wines. Mm-hmm. But then you have all the wines from South America, from New Zealand, from Australia, from South Africa. Some of the grapes they can be kind of biting. I can think of some, both white and red wines. I mean, you can find every quality in a wine, and it's infinite.
If you've just joined us, this is Festival Showcase, and we've been talking with pianist Jean-Yves Thibaudet about everything from his upcoming July 23rd performance of the Liszt Piano Concerto No. 2 to his love of both wine and music together. Now is the time to open your wallet and give. That's because your gift today helps make sure that everyone who lives in the Valley can continue to hear the voice of Fred Child and performance today through the year, and classical music from Aspen with me, Chris Moore, during the summer to keep us up with what is going on with the classical music world of the Aspen Music Festival and School. Discover the live concert recordings that can't be heard anywhere else. This music is freely available, but it's not free for us to bring it to you. Please do your part to make sure that Aspen Public Radio and this great music continues to thrive. Donate online at aspenpublicradio.org or on the phone at 970-920-9000. Next up, John Rojak, bass trombonist with the American Brass Quintet, which will fill the resident Harris Hall with sound on July 20th at 8 p.m. One of the concerts I always look forward to, frankly, is yours, just because the sound of the brass in Harris Hall just makes my hair stand on end. It is so beautiful in there. That hall seems to have been made for you almost.
That's what they said when they built it. We actually visited Harris Hall with hard hats when it was a construction site. We walked into the basement and the beams, and it was that presence that allowed it to be built with our spirits already in there in the construction right. site.
I'm wondering if you're playing any Renaissance music, Gabrielli or others.
We've often, almost always, actually open our concerts with some Renaissance music. And the past 40 years or so, they've usually been suites edited by Ray Mace, our former mm-hmm. trumpet player. Well, Ray's replacement is Louis Hanslick, and Louis has come up with a new suite of Elizabethan and Jacobean consort music, which I've just nicknamed Music of Betty and Jake.
I know sometimes you bring in a student brass quintet or five brass players from your collection of students to play something really big at the end. Are you doing that again this year?
We are. We have a fellowship brass quintet every summer since 2000, mm-hmm. and we like to include them. And again, Louis just discovered, he edited a couple of Gabrielli pieces that we've not played before. They're vocal pieces. One is for a double quintet, 10-part. And the other, we get a bonus 11th player. We're adding one of Mike Powell's other students on trombone, so we have an 11 piece. And it's a piece that sort of has three players set apart, and that would be the low brass from ABQ, Eric Reed, Mike Powell, and myself.
When you play Gabrielli or some of the old Renaissance, some of them in their original performances were antiphonal. You would have different balconies at different parts of the church, and behind you or off to the left. You don't really go too far in that direction. Is it not acoustically a good idea to break something up into antiphonal sound in Harris Hall?
Actually, in one of the pieces, it is written for two choirs, mm-hmm. and we will be slightly apart, but it's not quite the same effect. Several years mm-hmm. ago, we played, and it's a spectacular piece, we played in the tent, Gabrielli's last canzona, which is for 22 parts divided into five choirs, and we were spread a couple of choirs on stage and three choirs in the choir loft. Mm-hmm. I think it was quite effective
yes.
that way.
I can only imagine. Well, as we go through time, once we get past your Renaissance pieces, tell us a little bit about other pieces we can look forward to hearing.
Our other trumpeter, Kevin Cobb, who, startlingly enough, he seems like he just joined the group, is now in his 19th season. My goodness. Has arranged a new set of Russian music from Ludwig Maurer, Anton Simon. Mm-hmm. which is a lovely set that'll be making its premiere. And we have a brand new piece, a world premiere from a trumpet player who just graduated Curtis in Philadelphia, Stephen mm-hmm. Franklin, which, even though it's brand new, is also a throwback. He's sort of been inspired by Schumann and Mendelssohn. It will be familiar and unfamiliar at the same time. But our modern piece on this concert is a piece that we played about 10 years ago in Aspen by Anders Hilborg. And Hilborg was composer in residence that summer, and we got to work with him a bit and learned his amazing brass quintet. It was rhythmic and exciting and every dynamic, and winds up after all this amazing rhythmic complexity into one of the most dramatic, stunning closing sections that I've ever heard in a brass quintet.
There'll be 10 of you. There'll be five students and the five of you in the ABQ.
Plus the bonus trombone.
And the bonus trombone.
So 11.
Please don't make it be me. I don't know how to play that instrument. Anyway, I'm sure there's plenty around here to pick from. I want to ask about your teaching philosophy, since your students get up there, and I will say I've heard this before, when you have 10 or more brass players in your concerts, the effect is staggering, and also the caliber of the playing. I feel like you are truly, and I mean this, playing with colleagues. They are very, very high level of musicianship that these students get to by the time they're up on the stage with you.
Well, the level at the Aspen Music Festival has been growing. It's always been fine, but somehow we've been able to get more and more of the top students in the country. In fact, this summer, my studio of bass trombonists is always at 4. I have 4 students over the summer. Mm-hmm. And this was the first year that I didn't get into my wait list, so I got my top 4 students that I mm-hmm. listened to blind, so I don't know who they are when I pick them. And a little bit to my dismay, there were the first three on my wait list were all former students of mine. I felt terrible about that. But the students I have are phenomenal, really wonderful players. Mm-hmm. There's an incredible wealth of music written for quintet that we have. Last year's concert in Aspen, we had two world premieres, which I found amazingly exciting.
Right.
And we have just great repertoire. So when people come to our concerts and hear music they've never heard before, and you know, a little trepidation, the unfamiliar, they invariably come away with saying what a wonderful experience it was. Now, when we coach groups, we don't instill our philosophy directly on them. We would love them to play serious brass music, but we like them to explore their own niche. And if they can find a way to be successful, to have some success, but not to be all over the map, to find something they excel, where they excel. And it might be pop music. Hopefully it's something that we don't even know about yet. And if they can find that, that would be the best.
When I was saying all over the map for you, I was thinking all the different eras from Renaissance to 21st century.
Right.
Not so much the Beatles arrangements or whatever.
Yeah.
I didn't mean that.
And no, and you know, some of the groups like the Canadian Brass, of course, and Empire and Dallas Brass and Rhythm and Brass, these other groups, they're wonderful. It's just, as one of our former trumpet players, Chris Gecker, said 25 years ago, the more we've remained the same, the more unique we've become.
I think that's true. That's true. So on the 20th, people will be hearing pre-Baroque music, and then from there, will there be any kind of Romantic era music?
The Russian set of Ludwig Maurer and Simon are from the late 1800s. And Maurer is sort of credited with the first real writing for modern brass quintet. It's about 1860s, the school that stemmed out of St. Petersburg, Russia, that brought us, as I'm sure every listener in the Roaring Fork Valley would know, the three or four brass quintets from Victor Ewald.
Well, John, I'm going to take my journalist hat off and just make a recommendation to people. Really give serious consideration to going to this. Just the sheer sound of these fabulous instrumentalists in Harris Hall. Harris Hall sounds lovely with string quartets and with other things, but it really comes alive with five brass players. And John, we look forward to hearing you Thursday with your colleagues and your students.
Thank you so much, Chris. We look forward to seeing everybody.
John Rojak of the American Brass Quintet talking up their upcoming July 20th concert at Harris Hall.
Sometimes you're moved by the sheer emotional power of music being played or its simple, perfect beauty. Music truly matters in your life, and your donation today provides the essential resources it takes to bring you and the community the joy of discovery of new favorites and the pleasure of revisiting hidden gems every single day. Aspen Public Radio is a unique service that makes music available to everyone and lets you know what's going on with the Aspen Music Festival and school all through the summer. Our existence relies on you standing with the music that matters so much in your life. Please make your difference now with your important donation online at aspenpublicradio.org or on the phone at 970-920-9000.
This has been Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the music and the artists behind the 2017 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School and previews upcoming performances. This program comes to you from Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and can be heard online at aspenpublicradio.org. Funding for Festival Showcase is provided by the Barnard Fane Foundation. Please join me Tuesdays at 3:30 or listen online. My name is Chris Moore. Thanks for listening.